Hello, and welcome to the supplementary DD&D podcast, where I come on and I apologize.
For being an idiot!
Because that was probably one of our best podcasts ever, and none of you are going to get to enjoy it, because I did Star 6 to keep me from disturbing the podcast. But since Kano was on my line as a merged call, you folks didn't get to hear any of it.
So it was 2.5 hours of mute.
Yes, yes. Yeah, there was no way for us to know that every time I hit Star 6, whether it worked or not, because we could talk to each other just fine.
Right, so we thought it was working excellent, and we really had a good podcast. Oh, my gosh, it was, like, awesome. I was just really excited to upload it. I went to listen to it afterwards, and there's practically nothing there.
Yep, yep. So I'm going to try to talk Kano into writing down those recordings that he did.
We can play those three recordings.
Yes. Yeah, why don't we play those three recordings? You guys can hear them. And I will not hit Star 6.
Right. And we just won't do all of our commentary that we did, because it'll take forever and we don't remember everything we said. It kind of sucks, but oh well.
Okay, but before you play your recording, I want to conduct a small experiment. I don't care what you say. Whether you do a count or whatever, all right, just, you know, do the, Big Bird song or something, and I'm going to hit the mute button, and I want to see if you can still be heard in the recording. So, 1, 2, 3.
Oh, that Big Bird song. Can you hear me? Oh, you want me to go test it and see if I can be heard in the recording?
Did you hear me when you asked me if you could hear me?
Oh, no, I could not hear you.
Okay, I muted myself. Now, you did respond.
Yeah.
And you effectively tested it. That's fine. You didn't need to do the Big Bird song. Okay. Go ahead and do your recording. I'm not muted, but we're going to test it right after we finish this.
Yes. Oh, okay, I got you. Okay, I got you. I'm a little Virgo. Okay. Yeah. So, let's find those audios. First audio is
the world's population keeps growing. By 2050, we'll have to double our food production. For that, we'll need genetic engineering, advanced pesticides, and fertilizer. Lots of fertilizer. That's why at Agricon, we're working every day, hand in hand with farmers and their families. And don't you want to feed the world?
How's that sound, Chris?
Messages like this one seem to be popping up everywhere, but who's really behind them? Turns out it's the corporations profiting from this way of farming, like those selling the pesticides, fertilizers, and chemicals. They're spending billions to warn us that their way is the only way, with industry groups like the Alliance to Feed the Future, whose members include the Association for Dressings and Sauces and the National Frozen Pizza Institute. But ask farmers who really know how to feed us, and you'll get a very different story, a heartbreaking and hopeful story that I've heard talking to hundreds of families like this one. 50 years of this myth and the lobbying dollars to support it have tilted the playing field to favor corporate-controlled chemical agriculture, giving farmers little or no support for any other path. So it's easy to understand. A lot of farmers feel it's either get on board or get out. Getting on board means farmers stop practices that keep soil healthy and go for single crops. Livestock that used to be raised on the farm get crammed into polluting factories. To keep this unnatural system going, these farmers now buy expensive inputs, all from ever fewer corporations demanding ever-rising prices. It's a quick addiction. Pests become resistant, so you've got to use more chemicals. Livestock become sicker, so you've got to use more drugs. Soil loses its natural fertility, so you've got to use more chemical fertilizer. Then on the other side, when farmers try to sell their crops, they face only a few big buyers offering unpredictable prices. The economics don't work for long. Over the last 50 years, millions of desperate farmers have had to sign contracts with corporations that dictate their every move or have lost their farms altogether. More and more, farm income is concentrating at the top, so now only 1 in 10 U.S. farms can support a family. In many other countries, a similar thing is happening. Small farmers who buy into the promise that corporate agriculture is the solution often get trapped by debt and dependency. So yes, corporate agriculture is good for some folks, including some of the largest growers, but not the typical farm family. And that's strike one for this myth. But we have to feed the world, right? And if not this way, what choice do we have? A great one. We just don't see ads for it, and it certainly isn't getting the subsidies going to corporate ag. State-of-the-art sustainable farming ends this unnatural chemical addiction. It uses better practices, not ever more expensive purchases. Sustainable farmers build healthy soil by planting a variety of crops and rotating them. They raise their animals on the farm, not in cramped factories. They fertilize using compost and livestock for planting soil-nourishing crops. Healthier plants with good crop rotation also help keep pests in check without hurting the bugs we need, like those all-important pollinators. How does this choice impact everyone else? Massively. Industrial farms degrade and erode precious topsoil. 64 tons per acre are being lost every year in some spots in our heartland. They suck up huge amounts of water, a lot of it from deep underground, essentially irreplaceable, and they use millions of pounds of antibiotics, a practice that leads to dangerous new bacteria. They also produce toxic runoff that pollutes our rivers, our oceans, and us. The average American already has at least 13 pesticides in our bodies. And thanks to chemicals in the field, farmers and farm workers have higher rates of many cancers. So the sustainable farm is better for farmers and the environment, but can it really feed the world? Study after study is saying yes. Sustainable farms produce as well, and in drought years, even better. This is important news for small farmers who already grow 70% of the world's food. To increase production, they don't have to follow the chemical path. And the future we're all talking about feeding? The industrial farm requires more fossil fuels, water, and mined minerals. All stuff that will only get more expensive as it runs out. So down the line, the chemical path not only can't work for farmers, it won't be a choice at all. Corporate agriculture doesn't reliably grow more food in the future or even today. And that's strike two for this myth. But we still haven't looked at the biggest hole of all. They say we need to double food production or we'll go hungry. Really? We already have almost 3,000 calories a day available for every human being on Earth. More than enough. And that's after wasting a third of all food grown. And a lot of what is grown isn't food we eat directly. A third of the world's grain is going to livestock. In the U.S., our biggest crop is corn, but less than 1% of all corn planted is what we eat. Most goes to fuel or feed. So staying on this track, we could increase production and still have more hunger. To end it, everybody has to have the power to buy or grow the food they need. And that's what sustainable farming is all about. Strike three for this dangerous myth. So the next time someone who makes frozen pizza or toxic pesticides tells you there's only one way to feed the future, tell them their story is full of holes. The evidence is clear. Sustainable farmers prove we all can enjoy healthy food, and we each have power to make this happen. We can redirect our own food dollars and the billions in public money now going into the pockets of Big Ag. We can stand up and speak out for sustainable farmers here and around the world.
Yeah! Start growing your own food in your backyard.
Yes! Save the planet.
Grow your own garden.
Anyway, before you play the next recording, was that, I didn't notice the first time you played it, but was that beep, 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 beep coming from your truck, or was that in the recording?
I think it was in the recording.
Oh, okay. I didn't notice it the first time. All right, it sounded like a truck noise, so I wanted to have you have a chance to fix that before doing the next recording. All right. Okay, well, that was good. All right, go ahead and do the next one.
The world's population keeps growing.
That beeping?
No, it was more to the middle of the recording. It sounds like your truck dash making beeping noises.
Yeah.
But all the words were quite clear. All right, so everything came through. It's just, I guess I didn't notice it the first time, that's all.
All right. Okay, here's the second one.
Growing your own usually means moving to the country, plowing the fields, cultivating the crops, harvesting the bounty for your table. But these days, more people are turning to their own backyards to create urban farms. One Southern California family is at the forefront of that movement. Drivers moving past on the 210 freeway through Pasadena have no idea that a stone's throw away from the fast lane is a lush but tiny Eden, a 4,000 square foot farm. It not only feeds the family, but revolutionizes the idea of what can be done in a very unlikely place, the middle of a city.
This is city living. But I brought the country to the city rather than have to go out to the country. I just supported it.
63-year-old Jules Gervais started this backyard farm 10 years ago. It's a deliberate throwback to the storied days of self-reliant rural America. Jules and his children grow almost all the food they need, and everyone pitches in.
I have pounds of grapefruit.
His daughter, Anise.
Oh, we have another guy coming to pick up.
And Jordan.
Yeah.
Are you done?
Okay.
And his son, Justin. Their produce is organic, and their animals are, well, friendlier than average.
Say hi. Say hi. We have eight chickens, 4 ducks, and 2 goats. I joke with people because I think my animals fit better in a city backyard than a lot of dogs in the neighborhood.
The ducks and chickens lay thousands of eggs a year and keep the bugs in check.
And they really made the dynamics of urban homestead much more sustainable.
Sustainable and dense. On their 4,000 square feet, they raise 400 varieties of vegetables, fruits, and edible flowers. 6,000 pounds a year, enough to feed themselves with plenty left over. And with the current passion at high-end restaurants for local pesticide-free produce, chefs are literally beating a path to their door.
Hi, how are you?
So good. How are you doing?
We have your order for today.
Oh, wonderful.
And your sorrel here. So what are you going to do with the sorrel?
I'm going to use it to make a really nice relish with cucumber for a salmon dish.
The family makes about $20,000 a year from their front porch sales. They use it to buy the crops they can't grow, like wheat, rice, dope.
I would say at the beginning, I didn't really believe I could do it. I had some doubts because I kept thinking, this place is too small. There's no way that we're going to be able to feed ourselves. Plus, I never thought we could even grow the vegetables for the market.
So how did this experiment in independent living begin? It all began 10 years ago when Jules bought some taco shells for dinner. He learned too late that the shells were being recalled because they had been made by mistake with genetically modified corn.
When I thought about putting this food in my children's mouth and they were depending on me to give them good stuff, I mean, they'll take whatever any child will take what a parent hands them. They'll say, it comes from my mom or dad. And I couldn't afford to be in that position of giving them bad stuff.
Now, a decade later, this radical foodie has succeeded in going off the grid. He calls his lifestyle the path to freedom.
And what did family think of that whole approach?
They thought it was strange. They thought it was my daughter wouldn't come out of the front yard and visit with her friends because they said, what's up with your dad? They wanted to know what was going on because I was making some radical changes here.
The Gervais have no ugly commute. They avoid office politics and will never get fired. But their jobs are way more than 9 to 5.
I need to help all the help I can get. And it's my family that, like in the old days, the farmer's family made the difference.
Jordan takes care of the animals.
A joke for them, we call them pet organic composting machines.
Justin is in charge of making sure they get the most out of every square foot of soil. And sometimes the results are extraordinary.
You actually grew this?
Yeah, it's like a little pumpkin, but it's very long.
Just slightly.
Slightly.
He's also the beekeeper.
Oh, my gosh, that's the first time I've ever done straight from the honeycomb.
Jules prides himself on his gourmet compost.
Yummy, yummy. Only worms could love them.
Could love
them. Oh,
Anish is in charge of cooking the vegetarian meals.
All homegrown, strawberries and edible flowers and salad and beets and carrots.
And the canning.
We got grape leaves, pickles, beans, and pickled peppers to all sorts of jams, tomato sauce.
And the menu? That depends on what's in season.
What happens when something's out of season?
We just don't eat it. You're out of luck. It's out of season.
There are no microwave ovens in this kitchen, and no Cuisinart either.
We have gizmos, but this is hand powered.
What little electricity they use is generated by these solar panels.
How much is your electricity bill?
Well, it's running about the highest $12 a month.
$12 a month for everything here.
Yeah.
They spend even less on gas. This is their biodiesel brewing station.
So this is just used grease from Russia.
Yeah, they use it to fry anything, stir fry, anything you would fry.
And you get it free?
Yeah, free and delivered to one of our stations.
The gasoline station is self-serve. It hasn't always been easy. Justin remembers the year that frost wiped out a crop. Another year, it was a destructive insect. And recently, they've noticed a new challenge, climate change.
We call it the forefront of global weirding because we've been gardening for so long, you can sense things are off. We have this June bug that comes out called June, so it's supposed to come out in June, but comes out in July and August and, you know, September. So something's definitely off.
The other challenge is water. Southern California skies don't deliver enough of it. So Jules keeps the water bill down with this ancient form of irrigation.
A clay pot irrigation.
It's buried under there.
It's buried usually up to the throat here.
Uh-huh.
And then all you do is fill it up. And the water weeps through the pores and through the clay. And you get the water where the plants need it at the root zone. Plants take the water as needed.
That's
so just so simple.
It's 5 o'clock, dinner time, the time when it all pays off. The Gervais are the ultimate locavores. Their food traveled a whole 100 feet from the field to the table. They all say they love urban homesteading and can't imagine living a typical consumer-driven life. But there's one thing they would like.
My plans are to have Homesteadville, which is...
What's Homesteadville?
A village of all homesteads. To start with my family would be there. They'll have their homesteads. Their extended family would be there, and people that want to live this lifestyle will be in there.
At the end of the day, some not-so-back-to-nature activity. Visits to their websites have grown dramatically. They get about 6 million hits a month from others interested in this grow-it-yourself revolution.
Growing food yourself is a dangerous act because you're in danger of becoming free. We're all in the same boat on the same planet, and there are people now asking deep questions about the future of the planet, and they're willing to do this. They're willing to take a risk.
It's a risk that has paid off for Jules and is blazing a trail for others.
Yeah. Now that he went public, New World Order is probably going to crack down on him, though.
Yeah. Did you play another one after this, or did we go to Ron Paul eventually?
I played another. After this, then we talked a little bit about, you know, basically we tried to do the same thing when you was living in California and I was living in Kansas City with our yards in the city. But our wives thought it was fruity.
Right. Well, by his own admission, his did too, but the difference is his wife and children decided to go with it.
Where ours didn't.
Right.
Well, mine kind of did. She went with it, but she didn't want to do the work, so I had to grow things that didn't require us to do anything.
Right.
Except
and mine accused me of eating grass.
You're making the kid Kawawa.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. I just had to plant things that were, you know, that's when I started getting into permaculture because I had to figure out how to get things to grow by themselves without me having to babysit them because I was on the road all the time. I couldn't be there to babysit them and Mary and the kids wouldn't do it. So I had to figure out how to make it grow on its own. And
permaculture requires people to do inputs.
Yeah. And so I was working on it. I didn't quite get there, but even in 2011, we had a drought. Some of my stuff still did pretty good, even though most of it died. So 2011 was a really bad drought. Everybody had a drought for everything. So I was surprised that the few things that I did grow survived. let's see here. The other one is right here.
Q&A. Threats to organic farming are soaring. Written by Tara Dodrill Off Grid Foods. Zero. Print this article. Print this article. Organic farmer speaks out. Image source, Cale University. The battle between biotech giants like Monsanto and organic farmers, as well as consumers concerned about food safety, has been raging in America for several years. GMO labeling laws are currently being considered in a multitude of states, while at the same time lawsuits proposed by both growers and GMO producing companies are clogging up court dockets. Biotech companies have successfully sued farmers for patent infringement on their genetically modified seeds, even in cases where the farmer did not plant a single GMO seed. Farmers have also begun to turn the tables and are suing neighboring growers in the biotech industry for GMO cross-contamination which destroyed organic crops. Off the Grid News recently sat down with agricultural expert and beekeeper Rick Austin to discuss the fate of the American farmer and the impact the genetic modification of the food supply is impacting both growers and consumers in general. Austin has written two best-selling books focused on sustainable and healthy growing habits, Secret Garden of Survival and Secret Greenhouse of Survival. Austin has also toured the country speaking about the threat genetically engineered crops pose to the bee population and how the loss of the honeybee would prove disastrous for both humans and animals. OTG, what types of threats to organic crops do GMO crops pose? Rick, for one thing, there is the problem of cross-pollination from GMO crops, both via the wind, as in corn pollination and via pollinators like honeybees. Since a farm growing GMO crops could be situated right next to a farm trying to grow organic crops, what the organic farmer could end up with next year would be seeds that were no longer organic and are instead contaminated with GMO DNA. And his new seeds from that pollination could quite possibly be sterile, since many GMO crops are designed to be sterile so that the farmer cannot save seeds and replant next year. Thus the farmer using GMO crops becomes a slave to buying GMO seeds each year, while the innocent bystander organic farmer has now lost years of genetically clean and organic work through the contamination of his crops by GMOs. Furthermore, Monsanto is actively suing innocent victims of its GMO pollen, when farmers through no fault of their own, have hybrid crops containing GMO DNA. Since Monsanto has a patent on its genetically engineered crops, small neighboring farmers are being sued by the chemical giant for patent infringement, which those small, innocent, and less than wealthy farmers do not have the resources to defend. New Survival Seed Bank lets you plant a full-acre crisis garden. Thus, Monsanto is putting small, non-compliant as in not buying Monsanto's GMO seeds, farmers out of business. The result is that the only farms left standing will have to buy Monsanto's GMO products. Truly, this is restraint of trade and extortion, disguised as patent violations. OTG, what are the challenges of being an organic farmer in such a chemical-saturated world? Rick, aside from being polluted and contaminated by GMO pollen, an organic farmer is also subject to the overuse of pesticide and herbicides that are used on neighboring GMO crops. Since GMO crops are now using more and more fertilizer, pesticides, and herbicides each year, just to maintain their unsustainable crops, these chemical contaminants often spill over into organic farms through airborne contamination, or through water and soil erosion onto the organic property. OTG, what is the solution to the GMO crop debate? Rick, the real solution is by requiring GMO labeling of any product that contains GMOs. This would be costly for the food manufacturers and packing companies. And if consumers were able to vote with their wallets, and as consumers become educated to the dangers of GMOs, they could choose not to buy GMO products, and could instead buy organic. The real challenge is in the incestuous relationship that Monsanto has with our government, where top Monsanto execs spend a stint in government agencies like the FDA, the USDA, and the EPA, who invariably block consumer watchdog efforts to stop GMOs, and who then go back to even better paid jobs at Monsanto, a reward for hurting the U.S. consumer. Obama's current food czar, who runs the FDA, is the former VP of public policy at Monsanto. Talk about the fox in the hen house. Interestingly, many countries outside the U.S. are not in Monsanto's pockets, and they have instituted GMO labeling and have in many cases outright banned the use of GMOs in their countries. It is not that the U.S. government doesn't care about its consumers, it is that the U.S. government is too corrupted by Monsanto dollars and lobbyists. OTG, does a crop have to be 100% organic to be truly organic? Because of cross-contamination by GMO crops and the chemical herbicides used on them? Rick, to be honest, I have come to hate the word organic because it has become more of a marketing term and a ploy than a truth. The term organic has been bastardized and misused so often that it has become a deception to consumers. Truly organic crops and foods are supposed to be very restrictive, but it is difficult to police that, especially with government agencies that would rather look the other way than do what is best for the people that actually pay their salaries, the taxpayers. I have coined a term, nature culture, that represents what I am doing in gardening, that is not only organic but it is simply the way nature has been growing fruits, nuts, berries, and herbs for millions of years. My gardening concept uses symbiotic relationships found in nature so that I can produce bug-free food, without the use of pesticide, fertilizer, or herbicides. OTG, what are your thoughts on the GMO food labeling debate? Rick, we must expose Monsanto for what they are, and bring awareness to people so that they can vote to change the way our food industry is going. This is difficult in a world with momentary consumer attention spans, sensationalist reality programs, and a mainstream media that are complicit in the crimes being committed by our government and chemical companies against the voters of this country and humanity in general. And we must start growing our own foods at home, so that we have a healthy choice and are not slaves to the corporate farming and industrialized grocery distribution system. Only when we can vote by eating our own homegrown food will the megalithic AG companies no longer have control over our destiny and our health. OTG, what are the most common misconceptions about the need for commercial crop fertilizers? Rick, we have overfarmed lands using this megalithic corporate farming mentality, planting monocrops over huge parcels, that have created topsoil and nutrient depletion in our ground, and therefore in our crops and in the food on our tables. The food in the grocery stores today, we have one-third the nutrients of the same food found in grocery stores in the 1960s. That means that we have to eat three times the amount of food that they did in the 60s just to get the same nutrients. Does anyone see the connection of why our society is so obese? We are starving for nutrients, and no matter how much we consume of commercially produced products, our bodies cannot get what we need. We therefore substitute even worse consumer food products that contain immense amounts of sugar using the number one food additive in food products, high fructose corn syrup, and are killing ourselves in the process. Oh yeah, did I mention that 98% of all corn grown in this country comes from GMO crops? Can you say poisoned high fructose corn syrup? There ought to be a skull and crossbones on every product with high fructose corn syrup in it, but of course, that would mean that most of the food on the grocery store shelves would have to carry that label. OTG, why are weeds good for the garden? Rick, people who have read my books, heard me speak, or seen articles written about my secret garden of survival, know that I say that weeds are good. That is because in nature weeds are pioneer plants. They are the first plants to occupy barren soil. Weeds will grow where nothing else will. They break up poor soil with their roots, and they make bad soil better through allowing air, water, and microorganisms into soil that would not support other life. In nature, weeds are the first plants in a whole line of succession. Weeds die back and provide nutrients for other plants to grow. Without weeds first creating inhabitable soil, we would not have had any other plants to follow, including the most mature of ecosystems like old oak forests. When chemical companies kill weeds for the expediency of creating commercial crops on a rapid timetable, they ultimately kill the very plants that could help them replenish the topsoil and the nutrients that are missing from our foods today. If we continue on this path, we will soon be eating flavored cardboard from our grocery store shelves. Don't forget to add the high fructose corn syrup.
Yeah, so the weeds are the first responders.
True enough. Okay, so Ron Paul next, because, yeah.
Yeah. Well, before we go there, yeah, we'll have to repeat this podcast next week, and hopefully the person who posted a comment on our DD&D Off-Grid Organic Farming Retreat wall will call in. Because they wanted to talk about not the FDA, but the I keep wanting to say MSDS because I deal with hazardous materials all the time.
Yeah, you're concerned about the FDA and Department of Agriculture, DA.
Yeah. They wanted to talk about the Department of Agriculture. So, yeah, we'll just redo this podcast next week, and hopefully they call in, and then we can have a discussion with them as well.
Actually, that text, I'd like you to send me a link to it, because you mentioned his book, so I'd like to do some research and see if I can get a hold of them.
Okay, it's also on the DD&D website, daviddavidanddavid.com.
Very good.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Ron Paul, I got to call that one in.
Yep.
Oh, I got to keep that. Oh, that's on you.
January 23rd. Throughout the presidential campaign, Donald Trump's foreign policy positions have been anything but consistent. One day we heard that NATO was obsolete and the U.S. needs to pursue better relations with Russia. But the next time he spoke, these sensible positions were abandoned or an opposite position was taken. Trump's inconsistent rhetoric left us wondering exactly what kind of foreign policy he would pursue if elected. The president's inaugural speech was no different. On the one hand, it was very encouraging when he said that under his administration, the U.S. would seek friendship and goodwill with the nations of the world, and that he understands the right of all nations to put their own interests first. He sounded even better when he said that under Trump, the U.S. world would not seek to impose our way of life on anyone, but rather to let it shine as an example. We will shine for everyone to follow. That truly would be a first step toward peace and prosperity. However, in the very next line, he promised a worldwide war against not a country, but an ideology when he said he would, quote, unite the civilized world against radical Islamic terrorism, which we will eradicate from the face of the earth, close quote. This inconsistent and dangerous hawkishness will not defeat radical Islamic terrorism, but rather it will increase it. Terrorism is not a place. It's a tactic in reaction to invasion and occupation by outsiders. As Professor Robert Pate explained in his important book, Dying to Win, the neocons repeat the lie that ISIS was formed because the U.S. military pulled out of Iraq instead of continuing its occupation. But where was ISIS before the U.S. attack on Iraq? Nowhere. ISIS was a reaction to the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq. The same phenomenon has been repeated wherever U.S. interventionist actions have destabilized countries and societies. Radical Islamic terrorism is for the most part a reaction to foreign interventionism. It will never be defeated until this simple truth is understood. We also heard reassuring reports that President Trump was planning a major shakeup of the U.S. intelligence community. With a budget probably approaching $100 billion, the intelligence community is the secret arm of the U.S. empire. The CIA and other U.S. agencies subvert elections and overthrow governments overseas while billions are spent spying on American citizens at home. Neither of these make us safer or more prosperous. But all the talk about a major shakeup at the CIA under Trump was quickly dispelled when the president visited the CIA on his first full working day in office. Did he tell them a new sheriff was in town and that they would face major and long overdue reform? No. He merely said he was with them 1,000%. One reason Trump sounds so inconsistent in his policy positions is that he does not have a governing philosophy. He is not philosophically opposed to a U.S. military empire, so sometimes he sounds in favor of more war, and sometimes he sounds like he opposes it. When President Trump, in this case, be more influenced by those he has chosen to serve him in senior position, we can hope not. Judging from their hawkishness in recent Senate hearings, Trump cannot be for war and against war simultaneously. Let us hope that once the weight of the office settles on him, he will understand that the prosperity he is promising can only come about through a consistently peaceful foreign policy. Thanks for calling this update. A new update is placed on this number, 888.
To repeat the announcement, press 1.
Wait for it.
To repeat the announcement, press 1.
Here it comes.
To repeat the announcement, press 1.
That's it.
Da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
All righty. Yeah.
Yeah, we didn't have much to say about Ron Paul. So although we did have a little bit to say about it, we had a lot more to say about the other stuff, and it's too bad we didn't actually record it.
Several times right after the inauguration. He's been in office for 6 hours. My lifetime hasn't changed one lick yet.
Yeah.
That's, you know, the doofus in office does not really affect your life, or at least doesn't affect my life.
No.
It's the whole administration, you know, that's independent of the doofus in office. That's the problem.
Doofus.
The whole concept of Let's elect somebody to fix all of our problems. No, get out of your dumb ass and fix your own problems.
Right. Love it or leave it.
Yeah, well, I left it.
Oh, yeah. Hey, let me add that. Hang on a second. I got something for you. This is an addition that wasn't on the other podcast.
Well, that's all right. We didn't put a lot of stuff in.
Yeah. All right, let me find it. Da 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 da. Here it is. Select all, copy, select all, paste, thank you. What? Ah, son of a biscuit.
Yeah.
All right, hang on.
Son of a biscuit.
Son of a biscuit. All right, select all, paste, thank you. All right, here we go. Not yet. On your mark, get set, stop.
People are dumb. You can say what you want about this country, and I love this place. I love the freedoms and liberties we used to have. I love it. I love that. You know? I loved it when it didn't take a fucking catastrophe to get us to care for one another. I love the fact that we are on camera all the time from all angles. But you know, you can say what you want about America, and I say I love this place. Land of the free, home of the brave. But we got some dumb mother f floating around this country. This ISNT just ranting and raving. This ISNT just blowing off steam. I have a little evidence to support my claim. It just seems to me that only a really low IQ population could have taken this beautiful continent, this magnificent American land that we inherited. Well, actually we stole it from the Mexicans and the Indians. But, hey, it was nice when we stole it. It looked pretty good. It was pristine. Paradise. Have you seen it lately? Have you taken a good look at it lately? It's fucking embarrassing. Only a nation of unenlightened half-wits could have taken this beautiful place and turned it into what it is today, a concentration camp. That's what we have here, America the Beautiful. Formerly known as the land of the free and the home of the brave. We have gotten complacent and allowed criminals to sell us into slavery, one law at a time. When people say love it or leave it, this is a cop-out. What they are truly saying is that they are too chicken shit to do anything about it. What they are saying is that they don't give two shits about their neighbor, their community, their homeland, nor their people. The Bible says, if you believe in that book, there will be no place to hide. Running from the problem is not the answer. You can leave, but you cannot hide. The New World Order is creeping into every country, every nation. Red, yellow, black or white. Male, female, gay, straight, or whatever your religious rights. Hand in hand, united we stand, or divided we will fall. So what are we going to do about it?
Love it or leave it, I say fix it or leave it.
Yeah! Did you get
yeah.
that? No, you lazy bastard, you get out of here. Fix it or leave it.
Fix it or leave it, you communist. Anyway, yeah. So we'll have to redo our podcast next week. So now we know what we're going to talk about next week. Same thing we talked about this week, but we didn't get to talk about it. Oh, you didn't get to hear us talk about it. That's what it was.
No, that's just it. I needed it all.
So next week, call in, tune in to the Dumb and Dumber podcast. I'm dumb. David Ray is dumber.
Dumber and dumbest?
It just all depends on the day. Sometimes I'm dumber and he's dumbest. I mean... Yeah, we're a couple of retards. Anyways.
Oh, yeah, you need to drive in a ditch again while I'm in the passenger seat, just so I can experience that again.
That was fun.
It was. Scary as hell. Don't worry, we repeat it.
Went from one ditch to another ditch.
Oh, my God.
Hey, I kept it on all four and got back on the road, didn't I?
Yes, you did.
You underestimated me.
You underestimated the road.
Well, it was stuck in four-wheel drive still. That's what the problem was. I made a wider turn than I wanted to make because the four-wheel drive was engaged. It wouldn't let me make the tight turn.
And had you not been in four-wheel drive, we would have been stuck.
Well, no, because it disengaged after we hit the ditch on the other side. I had to throw it back into four-wheel. I had to throw it back into four-wheel drive to re-engage it. While I was shifting gears.
Anyway. All right, well, that's the end for the Apology Podcast for Demented Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah, that was the short version of the long version that you don't get to hear.
Yeah. But we'll leave it up just so you can listen to that. You know, you might want it for your silent ringtone or something. I don't know.
Yeah, a 2-hour, 45-minute silent ringtone.
You'll have to trim the crap off at the beginning so that the rest of it will be silent. But other than that.
But yeah, Sunday, 7 p.m. Central Standard Time. Or 8 p.m. Central Daylight Time. The phone number's on the podcast, DementedDungeonsAndDragons.com. Just click on the podcast name. It'll take you to the podcast page, and it'll give you all the details.
Not all.
And make sure you call David Ray. Somebody call David Ray next Sunday and remind him to call in to the podcast.
Yeah, I think I'll do that.
Okay. All right, well, that concludes the DD&D podcast, DementedDungeonsAndDragons.com.
So long.
So long, farewell, auf Wiedersehen, goodbye.